15 minutes.
All right. Four, yeah.
Oh, there we go.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for May 17th and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 169A. What have we got, Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 169A directs the Oregon Health Authority to report to the 2015 Legislative Assembly on the burden of diabetes in Oregon and specifies data and information to be collected and reported. It sunsets responsibility to report upon convening the 2016 Legislative Assembly.
And who have we got?
Nikki Terzioff, Paul Manning, Stuart Perry.
And one more after that, is that right?
That's correct.
Good.
Elise Brown.
Elise Brown following this panel. For witness today, let's not have any overkill. Let's just do what you need to pass your bill. Shut up.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, Nikki Terzioff, Novo Nordisk. Thank you very much.
Hold on a moment.
Sure.
That's enough. Just kidding.
Yeah.
A little more than that.
This is one of these cases you don't want to talk yourself out of the bill.
Right. Pass your bill or you can keep talking.
Yes, let's go.
Nikki, go ahead.
Thank you. Nikki Terzioff, Novo Nordisk, here today in support of Senate Bill 169. I will be brief. I will simply introduce Mr. Stuart Perry, who helped to pass this very same bill in Kentucky. He'll talk a little bit about some of the outcomes they saw there.
Thank you, Nikki. Mr. Chair, I'm very disappointed that you asked for no overkill because I had a good 30-minute testimony that I really wanted to give.
I think you should. If you just step outside.
Go down the hall. Go down the hall, go to the place that says men.
No, right outside.
There's a mirror in there.
Exactly.
Just talk quietly.
I am Stuart Perry. I'm from the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and it takes us 30 minutes to say good morning in Kentucky. I apologize for my lengthy testimony, Mr. Chair. It is nice to see you again and the members of the committee. I really am here today to answer questions if you may have them. As you know, this bill is modeled after the bill that we passed in Kentucky. This bill is to do something to start the process about doing something about the epidemic, actually the pandemic we have of diabetes. I have diabetes. As I said, I'm from the Commonwealth of Kentucky, where from 1995 to 2010, we had 158% increase, according to the CDC, in diabetes. Congratulations. In Oregon, it was only a 65% increase. I will tell you, 65 is bad. Kentucky's was worse. Oklahoma's was worse than us. So around the country, this is a disease that we've got to stem the tide. It's a almost $3 billion problem to Oregon. If it's not stopped, it's going to be a $6 billion problem in a couple years. We developed this bill that's being used as a model across the country to ask different divisions of government to meet and come up with a strategic plan. That is probably, Mr. Chairman, the shortest answer about what this bill does that I can give. With that, I will tell you that I am available for questions, and I'll end my testimony with that and give you back the balance of my time.
Have you heard any opposition to this bill?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, no.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Paul Manning. I am the CEO of the Family YMCA of Marion and Polk Counties here in Salem, but more importantly today, I'm also representing our State Alliance of Oregon YMCAs. We are comprised of 11 YMCAs throughout the state, all dedicated to youth development, healthy living, and social responsibility. I'm also a member of the YMCA of the USA task force that is charged with scaling the YMCA diabetes prevention program nationally. We are currently at 80 YMCAs throughout the country, two of which are here in our state, one in Eugene, and our YMCA here in Salem. Our goal is to scale that program up to 600 YMCAs within the next 3 years. I share this with you so you understand that both nationally, throughout our state, and likely in the communities that you serve as well, the YMCA is dedicated to improving the health of our communities. That is why we're supporting Senate Bill 169. We feel this is vital to not only supporting the health of the state as a whole, but more importantly, individuals. I encourage you to grasp and understand the financial implications and the epidemic nature of this. But what in my brief statement, I would share with you not to forget that this affects members of our communities on an individual basis. We know that one out of four children, if we don't improve what we're doing, are going to contract diabetes within a lifetime. So for me, that's either my son Cameron, my son Jack, my daughter Julia, or my daughter Jenna. One of the four of them will have diabetes if we continue down this path. So that's why we support Senate Bill 169.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions in this panel?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Perry, I miss 65% increase in diabetes in Oregon over what time frame?
1995 to 2010. That comes from a report from the CDC dated November the 16th of 2012.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
That 65%, how many of those are type 1, type 2 diabetics?
Nationally, it's about 5% of type 1. So about 95%, I would say, would probably be if the national figures. They don't actually keep that figure to say this is how many type 1, this is how many type 2. But nationally, it's about 5% is type 1 versus 95% being type 2.
With that there in the states, like how many are on the Oregon Health Plan? And then on top of that, how many of them are on supplemental nutrition assistance programs?
That's a question I couldn't answer. I don't know whether we could try to find that, Nikki, and get back to you on that.
I assume could be a part of the strategic plan to have that kind of information available.
Yeah, that would be part of the data. When we did the plan in Kentucky, the data was what was most remarkable thing that came out of it. We passed it. 2 years later, we did the plan. And the plan is just out. As a matter of fact, our legislature has not even seen the plan. It's been presented to them, but they had other things that were much more pressing in the legislature, like budgets and redistricting and those kinds of things that took all their time. So in the interim, they're going to have a hearing and look at the data. But the data did address some of that stuff. So that data probably is somewhere in Oregon within the Oregon Health Authority, but I don't have it with me.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Lise Brown. Same caution.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Elise Brown for the American Diabetes Association, and here to signal our strong support, proud support of Senate Bill 169. Before you in your electronic file, you have a letter that's presented on behalf of the Diabetes Association from Laura Keller. And we do support this legislation, as it's a really terrific complement to legislation that's been passed in the past by this body, and it's going to do a great deal to keep Oregon out front of diabetes activities. And just to kind of talk about the numbers, they presented some great statistics, but the startling number for Oregon is 800,000 Oregon residents are affected by diabetes. So it's this kind of work that's going to be great. And you remember your former colleague, Scott Brune, before this body earlier this session. And Mr. Chair, you asked him, what could this body do to help those with diabetes in Oregon? And Scott's quick answer was, pass Senate Bill 169. So here again today to ask for your support. Thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Elise. Elise?
Quick question. Yeah. If you know the answer, the 5% on type 1, 95% on type 2, are they growing at equivalent rates?
I would say type 2 is growing at a faster rate.
Way faster.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative Kenny Geyer. Type 2 is growing at a faster rate.
Okay.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 169 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 169.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 169A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 169A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative
Penn.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative
Kramer. Aye.
Representative
Wiley. Aye.
Representative
Boyden.
Aye.
And
Chair
Dreyer.
Aye.
And
Chair
Thompson. Aye. Motion passes. Who would like to carry this?
I'll carry it.
I'll carry it. Son with diabetes and a father with diabetes.
You got it. Representative Wiley will carry the bill. Close the work session on Senate Bill 169. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 572 for the purpose of taking testimony from Senator Monis Anderson, and then I'll leave it open, but we'll get back to it later in the agenda. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, committee. Good afternoon. I'm State Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and that represents Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview. And I am here in strong support of Senate Bill 572, which requires hospitals to create and implement safe patient handling policies. And as a public health nurse, I didn't really work in the hospitals except when I was in my nursing training, but I was doing home health. And I know how critical when I'm in there turning patients, a dead weight, about a 250-pound man who has MS who cannot move, and you need to turn him. And I would be going in, and since the wife was the only caregiver, I would help her change the beds or change his clothes, etc. And they do. We really need to have techniques for our workers to be able to prevent some of these injuries. It's nurses and nursing aides and other healthcare workers. They regularly sustain a variety of on-the-job injuries, and I think you're going to hear from some of them later on. This happens while they're moving their patients, of course, and all these injuries are preventable. Instead of manually lifting patients, making one subject to strain, sprain, and other injury, healthcare workers can and should be using lift equipment. And all hospitals do have these lift equipment, including the rural hospitals. It's safer for the workers. It takes a whole lot of stress off of the bodies. But it's safer for the patient, too. New Jersey hospitals recently saw a significant decrease in patient injuries after that state implemented the safe patient handling legislation, very similar to what is being proposed to do. You have before you the -5 amendments, which comes from the efforts of a coalition of healthcare workers and safe patient handling experts. And this amendment goes, I feel, great lengths to allow hospitals to create for themselves individualized policies that utilize technology and equipment that they already own. And I support the -5 amendments because I do believe it gives the most protection.
Sorry, the -5 amendments to the Senate bill, or is that the Senate bill?
It should be to you, to yours. Is that Felisa will be able to explain the number. All I know is it's an amendment, and it was my understanding it was the -5s.
Yeah. Okay, I see. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we actually considered this amendment in the Senate Health Care Committee, but ultimately had to actually pass out a weaker version of the bill because we knew there would be a vote problem on the floor. And so that's why we passed this out to you. But then it was toward the end of the session, so we passed out that weaker version just so that we could keep the bill alive since we were running down on along with the deadlines, with the hopes that maybe you would be able to restore it into the intended bill. So I do urge you to support the strengthened version of Senate Bill 572A. Thank you very much.
Great. So you support the amendment then?
I do support the amendment.
And we'll figure out how to deal with it as we...
Yes. Yes. If okay. We would have to figure out how...
Co-sponsors of the bill.
Yes.
Good, Senator. Are there right. questions of the Senator?
I guess I would have one question. If there was problems with the -5 or the stronger
right.
one, we put those in, that means it goes back with those problems and
we would have to have a Concurrence. A concurrence.
A conference committee, which I assume the senator and I will be actively involved in.
Very actively involved.
Well, I would assume that as well, since it's your bill. I could say I would not be actively involved.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll leave this hearing open, but we'll move on to other business and get to both 572 and 724 for more hearing later in the session, later in this committee meeting. As is, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 281. Mr. Administrator, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 281 adds post-traumatic stress disorder to the definition of debilitating medical condition for the purpose of authorizing medical use of marijuana.
Do I have a motion on
281,
please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves Senate Bill 281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Everybody can get
Is there discussion?
I'm sorry.
Thompson?
I missed something there.
It was 281, the PTSD.
281 is what we've just moved.
And isn't there an amendment?
Can I say something for a discussion?
Sure. Well, let's Representative Thompson and then you.
Okay. It was going to be about the same thing.
I'm going to vote no on this bill, not because it might not be helpful from a management standpoint, but I have a real problem with the way we are addressing medical marijuana in this state. We have no control over the quality, the quantity, the distribution, the efficacy, or anything else. I was at a meeting 2 weeks ago of the drug and alcohol people. Medical marijuana from Oregon has now been identified in the trade stream as far away as Miami. And that corresponds with a situation that happened recently in my district where a medical marijuana cardholder was told by her provider that he would no longer be able to supply marijuana to her because the sale on the open market was too lucrative. So she lost her cardholder supplier. I don't know of any other disease state in which we prescribe in statute a treatment mode for which there is no treatment available of known standardized quality. We don't have any sideboards on this thing. We have FDA guidelines for reduction of plant material for pharmaceutical use. They aren't applied in this case. And I think this puts us statutorily at a huge disadvantage to be able to move forward. Eventually, this is going to blow up. I have seen data brought to me by proponents of medical marijuana that about material in the supply line that's contaminated with rodent feces, with mold, with bug parts, and a host of other things. That is not something we should be taking pride in here in Oregon. I don't doubt that there are producers out there who do a good job. We don't know who they are, and they aren't licensed or recognized for having done a good job. I don't doubt there are probably individual producers that are growing their own that are doing a good job. We don't know who they are or what they're doing. I do know we have a number of cardholders in my district that cannot procure quality material through the normal system, and many of them don't want to grow it at home because they have children at home. So the program is 30 degrees skewed from reality. I will support this and any other amendment to add new disease states to this at such time as we have a standardized, reliable production system that the state has some guidance in, as we would in any other pharmaceutical product. You can't manufacture vitamins in this state without licensing and stringent quality control matters, but yet we're producing marijuana by any means possible and turning it out to the public as if it's an efficacious treatment mode, and some of it flat out, some of it that I've seen that's been contaminated with pesticide is flat out dangerous. And I just am not going to buy into supporting this under the present conditions. So I will be a no vote on this.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. I do want to point out two things. One, One is, we did pass a bill earlier in the session that should help the supply chain and make, deal with the rodent and the other thing, I hope. If that gets through, I think that's sitting somewhere right now, waiting action. I also don't intend to move the amendment to the bill, but I do want to ensure the committee and others that there will be a workforce, a work group, working on the much larger question that's asked in the amendment, and I think it may end up being a bicameral work group to deal with it. So we are committed to moving in that direction, either jointly between this committee and the judiciary, or in a much larger context that I think leadership is very interested in moving. So we will do that. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, for your comments. I am vigorously in support of this bill after the testimony the other day. I went into it very open-minded, and anyone that's been to this committee often has probably seen me come to tears on more than one occasion. I get very moved by what people say, and it's rare that I'm joined by several grown men in those tears. It was very compelling, I think, both from an emotional point of view and a rational point of view, the kind of data that they talked about, the scientific reviews, and the lack of available treatments through, I forget the name of the two FDA-approved treatment for this that has shown to be very ineffective and, in fact, can have side effects, including suicide. So I would hate to wait for a work group to look at the big picture and not move ahead on this. It's happening already. People are doing it, and the result is they do it underground. I think that the House Bill 3460, which the chair was referring to, I hope that passes, because I think it's a start at some of the things that you talked about in terms of making sure in our distribution system the marijuana is studied to make sure that there's not mold and mildew and pesticides and things like that. So I think we're inching along on some improvements to what we have out there. I think the work group is critical to look at the big picture. Because I think when you keep adding things piecemeal, the piece in itself might make sense, like the Oregonian article yesterday about bereavement and the whole OFA. But it is important to step back and look at the whole picture. I feel the same way about nurse parity. So I think the work group is really important. I was convinced by them that it makes sense to keep the work group separate and not tie it to this one specific piece. But I heartily support 3460, the PTSD bill, and the work group.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I too, have some
concerns. Representative Kenemar. I guess I should announce names for everybody. Thank you. Too, for people listening on audio.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too have concerns about a specific treatment being prescribed by the legislature statutorily. I think that's an inappropriate way to deal with a condition like this. And secondly, you know, for the work group, I think there might be an additional issue. I've been contacted by a garbage collector in my district who is having difficulties with a large apartment complex where there are a number of medical marijuana cardholders. On one occasion, he collected 65 pounds of leaves and other kinds of marijuana materials that were discarded. This week he found another 10, and the local high school students and junior high students are stopping by now and have found this to be quite a supply house. And it raises some of the other questions about whether it's, you know, the safety and all of that being in the garbage can on top of it. So that's my comment. Thank you.
So in my naivete asking around, what is it you smoke in a marijuana plant? It turns out it's not the leaves.
No, it's that's what I understand. But what is that little white? The little, isn't it a white thing? I don't know.
I was told it's the buds.
Yeah, the buds, and there were a lot of buds in this discarded material.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Waste of selling. Yes,
I may. This is a tough one for me as well. I have a son who actually served over in Iraq, came back, suffered through PTSD. And I mean, we've had lots of conversations, and the support network that we got him involved in was, we had a lot of contacts through church and different things like that, where he had some people come around him and had a strong support group meeting with him, praying with him, and things like that. And it worked for him. But he said to me one night on the phone, he said, "Dad, you know, out of the group of men that I went over with, he knew of five that had committed suicide out of his group. Because not all of them have a support group to reach out to. And I'm not sure if this is the answer. I think it's something we need to watch very closely. We need to look at very seriously. But the one thing, talking with enough recreational users and all the jokes about marijuana, it definitely calms someone down and makes them want to eat Doritos and sit on a couch, I guess. But, I mean, if it's something that takes the edge off. We just had a young man in my district who basically went after a state trooper, had just snapped at some point, ended up in a high-speed chase, stopped. He was shot by one officer, but he had snapped, and he was going through PTSD as well. And this happened in the small community of Yamhill-Carlton. So it's a serious issue, and if this is something that'll take the edge off to keep a guy from going through a situation like that, I think it's something we need to do. But I am very concerned, as Representative Thompson just went through, and it's why I was supporting one of the bills that was before us, and how we monitor this program to make sure people are getting the right stuff. And I feel bad that we didn't get anything done. I mean, we have something going there with dispensaries, but we're not monitoring the plants and the quality of the plants. And we would have had that with the other bill. And I would have liked to see a combination. Yeah. So with that, I mean, I'm going to support this out of the committee just because I know what's going on. And it's troubling. Would it be the direction I'd want my son to go? No. My wife suffers from chronic pain. Would she ever do this? No. But do I have people say, oh, she should, but my wife's not going to strike up a bong or a joint in front of our children. I mean, it's not something that would ever happen in our household. But if somebody doesn't have a support system and this is the only thing that can bring them to where they can get to where they're feeling normal or not on edge, I'm willing to give it a shot because I know what's going on in their lives. So.
Thank you, Mr. Weidner.
Mr. Chair, as one who has suffered from PTSD and medication was not an option that worked for me, I had to find alternatives. Now, I found an alternative that was not marijuana, but I have friends who served in Vietnam and have served in other wars since that have suffered for years, and frankly, the only thing that has provided them some help is marijuana. And I think it's a crime that the only choice we give them is to be a criminal in order to obtain that marijuana. And while I share some of your concerns, I share more concerns about their life and what they're going through and the fact that we need to be doing more.
Thank you, Bill. Yes.
I just have a question.
What's up, Congress?
Why are we not adding the amendment with the work group so that there will be a formal legislative directive and staffing to support it to follow up on some of these concerns?
Because I don't want to make the bill a problem going back to the Senate and having more trouble, especially since we've already agreed to have it. So I don't think it has anything to the situation, and it has the potential for endangering this bill as it goes back to the Senate. If we pass it, it's passed.
Do you think it would endanger it?
Yes. We will go there, so it's really not, I think, it really doesn't need to be there.
Been 6 years we've been struggling to deal with this since I've been here, and everything gets shot down and killed when we try to regulate it.
We'll see if we can do it. Okay. Yes.
Let me be very clear. I am not questioning the potential efficacy of this for PTSD, but I think it's fraudulent on our part to connect PTSD with a medical marijuana, bear gallbladder, or anything else that's out there that we can't provide or allow provision of quality treatment material before we go this route. And I see more of it coming. There are more issues coming down that we're going to do one at a time to add into this program before we ever get around to doing anything about a quality supply line. And we've got to get the horse in front of the cart.
Yeah. How do you get a quality supply line without federal approval of marijuana?
Well, those are all issues, but other states are doing it, so.
Okay. Would you call the vote, please? Oh, sorry? Yes, yeah, Representative Quinn. Yeah. Cough or something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with almost everything Representative Thompson said. I am not a fan of about 80% of the users of the program, I think, including my friends who once had a hurt knee and now have their card, and lots of other people. But I'm not sure I wouldn't rather just accelerate the disaster that's this program and get it fixed for people who really need it and get all the people who don't need it off, or just legalize it, which I've never been in favor of. But it's just this is just a joke. This has become a national laughing stock for a good chunk of the people who are on the program. Then there's people like my father-in-law who was dying of cancer, and his doctor said, "You really, it'll help you with nausea, and it will help you, it was some other, get an appetite." And he couldn't get it because John Ashcroft would have imprisoned or, you know, taken the license from our doctor, so he couldn't get it except to figure out some way to buy it illegally. Or my dad, who just drank for 30 years, and you know, I had no dad growing up because he was drunk all the time because he killed people in Vietnam and couldn't sleep. And so for as much of a joke, I think this whole, not the whole, some large chunk of the program is a joke. I think that whether work group or not, something has to change to make this either legitimate dispensary quality regulation or just legalize it at that point. So I'm going to vote for it.
Now that he's agreed with you, Representative Thompson, you want to change your mind?
No, because now I'm even more scared. He never agrees with me.
Please call the roll.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
No.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Kinnear?
No.
Representative Whiteley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Jeanne Dyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
No.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Bill passes. Representative Lively, will you carry it?
Yeah. Yes, I'd be glad to.
Close the work session. We're in Senate Bill 281 and open a work session on Senate Bill 167A. What do we have here, Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 167A grants authority to the public health director to authorize licensed pharmacists to administer vaccines to persons 3 years of age or older in a declared emergency or disease outbreak.
Thank you. Do we have a motion?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 167A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 167A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, President Conger.
I just have a question. Was there at any point any discussion about what kind of disease outbreak? So in the case of a non-life-threatening influenza, I just want to make sure that the nature of the bill is such that there's a disease outbreak, it's not life-threatening. This doesn't mean that pharmacists or anyone else for that matter could suddenly just be administering vaccinations without obtaining proper parental consent, without full disclosure and everything else. It's not suspending anything else. It's just allowing for the administration of the vaccines in a disease outbreak by pharmacists and everything else.
It changes the age from, what is it, 12 now? Down to 3 in this circumstance. Do you want to talk about Representative Thompson?
Well, my understanding is that these are disease outbreaks that are actually declared by the governor, and it puts into effect a number of, well, they're already in effect, a number of permissions that the governor can grant under that, and this extends these. So there, it has to be a real disease outbreak, and it's not up to the pharmacist to decide. It's up to the state to decide if it's a disease outbreak or not.
And the disease outbreak, the term is defined in ORS 431-260. You can take a minute and track that down. That's 431.260. So any other comments while we're...
See, we have people here from the immunization program. Do you want to get it clarified?
Somebody want to come up and talk to us? But the point is, what this does is reduce the age limit from 12 now down to 3. Public health director. Hi.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lorraine Duncan, immunization program manager for the Oregon Public Health Division. So the bill basically would allow Mel Cohn, or the current director of the Public Health Division, in an outbreak to ask pharmacists to immunize from the current law, which is 11, down to 3. And it would also allow the governor to do the same, or the governor in an emergency like an earthquake or a flood or some other situation.
So may I follow up? The definition, thank you for pointing me to that, Mr. Chair. It says, disease, and I had looked at this before, disease outbreak means significant or notable increase in the number of cases of a disease or other condition of public health importance, which is extraordinarily broad. That could be the common cold, you know, significant increase in the number of cases of cold. My question was, I understand that the change in age, and I understand that this would allow pharmacists to administer vaccines. What I want to make sure of is that with this pretty broad authority, there are people who object for religious reasons or whatever to the administration of medications to themselves or their family. Fluoride being an example in water, but a better example would be vaccines. I know there are people who don't, who have objections to vaccines. So I just want to make sure that there isn't a situation where, other than, you know, some kind of virus that is killing off mass numbers of people, that you would have a significantly broader category of healthcare providers able to vaccinate, say in a school, for example, without obtaining parental consent.
Chair Greenlee and Representative Congress, so the pharmacist would be immunizing, but it would only be on a voluntary basis.
Yeah.
There would be no requirement for people to get it. It's that in an outbreak setting, the only thing that's governed by law in Oregon is the school immunization law for daycares and schools, and that is a requirement, but there's several exemptions currently for that, for non-medical and medical exemptions. So it is required for them, but they can get an exemption. What pharmacists would be doing is on a voluntary basis. They wouldn't be giving immunizations to somebody who didn't want to do it.
And that almost answers my question, but when you say voluntary for a three-year-old,
so in Oregon, if you're 15 or above, you can sign for your own immunization. Otherwise, it has to be for your parent.
Okay, thank you.
Where this really applies is if we had a major disease outbreak and there was immunizations available, you might set up stations like the high school or the fairgrounds where large numbers of people would go to be immunized.
Right.
It's unlike a three-year-old to go there by themselves, and they couldn't be anyway without permission. But families would go there, and we'd be able to use pharmacists along with doctors and nurses as available to do these immunizations. And this would only apply also to pharmacists who are trained and certified to do immunizations in the first place.
Understood. Thank you.
Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Finnemer?
Aye.
Representative Whiteley?
Aye.
Representative Whitener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dean Dyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
I have a motion carries. Representative Thompson, will you carry it, please? Close the work session on Senate Bill 167A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 172. What do we have here, Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 172 directs the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules requiring all infants born at birthing facilities located in the state to be screened for congenital heart defects by January 1st, 2014, and declares emergency effective on its passage.
Do we have a motion on this one, please?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 172 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves Senate Bill 172 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We heard the testimony on this under two different bill names. Is there any discussion of this? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Quinn?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kinney
Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Zimmer? All right. Motion carries. Representative Conger, would you like to carry this one? No. You, sorry?
Sure.
Representative Conger will carry this one on the floor. Close the work session. Senate Bill 172. Open a work session on Senate Bill 384A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 384A requires the Health Authority to develop and prescribe criteria for training and treatment of opioid overdose and specifies training requirements. It allows a person, upon successful completion of the training, to possess, administer, naloxone for treatment of opioid overdose. It clarifies the Health Authority's role and increases oversight at local level. It authorizes a person prescribing and dispensing naloxone to distribute naloxone to trainees directly. There are trainers that will distribute to trainees. It exempts a person providing emergency treatment for civil liability except for wanton misconduct and declares emergency effective on its passage.
Is there any discussion on Senate Bill 384A? It does. We did learn toward the end of the last hearing that the main way this is used is with a syringe with a nasal adapter, and is done intranasally as the method. Would you call the roll, please?
Do you have a motion?
Oh, I'm sorry. So you can call the roll anyway.
Okay.
Do we have a voting?
Just in case we need it, I'll make the motion. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 384A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 384A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. If there is discussion, now is the time. Now we can go to the roll call.
Representative Quinn?
Okay. Sounds good.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnaman?
Aye.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Representative
Weiss?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Green.
Motion carries. Representative Kenny Geyer will carry this on the floor. Close the work session on Senate Bill 384A. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 460A. Mr. Minister, what do we have and who do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 460A restricts substitution of biosimilar products for prescribed biological product, clarifies biological product corresponding license biosimilar product are interchangeable. It deletes prescribing practitioner from record retention requirement, sunsets physician notification requirement January 1st, 2016, has an operative date of January 1st, 2014, declares emergency effective on its passage.
And who will we have testify?
Paul Cosgrove and Fawn Berry.
And can we not have too much testimony on large molecules versus small molecules?
Oh, come on.
A little bit.
Taking the fun out of it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Paul Cosgrove, representing Amgen. And Amgen is one of the manufacturers and marketers of innovator biologic drugs that are injected and treat serious diseases in the country. And it's also one of the companies that is developing biosimilars. I'm briefly going to walk through the elements of the bill. I know each of you have heard about this bill. But before I do that, I'd just like to mention that there is one difference, perhaps, since you've last heard about this bill. And that is, as Ms. Berry will confirm in a few minutes, The opponents and the proponents have reached an accommodation on the terms of this bill. So I start with that message. As you know, biosimilars mean they are similar but not identical to the biological products, and this bill deals with the circumstances under which a pharmacist can and under what conditions the pharmacist must have before there can be a substitution of a biosimilar drug for the originally prescribed innovator biological drug. And there are really five different conditions in the bill. One is that the Federal Food and Drug Administration has approved the biosimilar as an interchangeable biosimilar, able to be interchanged. Not quite identical, but almost identical. The second is that the physician or prescriber can choose not to allow substitution, which is true of any kind of drug that is prescribed. The third is that the patient must be informed about the substitution. The fourth is that the pharmacist must keep records of the substitution. And the fifth is, and this is the one that had been caused some controversy, is that there needs to be notification after the fact back from the pharmacist to this prescriber. The way we have resolved that issue, that fifth issue for which all the dissension has occurred previously, is to provide that for the next 2 years, that will be the process we use in Oregon. That provision will then sunset, and depending on developments both in the industry and in other law, we will maybe be back before you in 2015 to discuss this issue again, but at least for the next 2 years there will be pharmacist notification back to the physician of a substitution. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
And that's Section 5 is what you're talking about, sunset.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fawn Berry, representing Mylan, Inc. Mylan is one of the leading U.S.-based manufacturers of generic and specialty medications. Mylan, like several others in this building, opposed the doctor notification provisions under the original version of Senate Bill 460, but we are okay with the version as it is moving forward. We did want to state for the record that any future extension of the sunset we would be opposed to, as would other members of our coalition.
Are there any questions? Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 460A, and we might as well go ahead and work on the bill. It's a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 460A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves Senate Bill 460A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of that motion? Sorry. Oh, we're rolling, huh? Can you call the roll?
Representative Kenner will carry it on the floor
and close the work session on Senate Bill 460.
Will we be permitted to ask questions about the size of the molecules on the during the floor debate? Or?
Absolutely. Second thought. I think we have another person deciding to carry the bill, Mr. Chairman.
I can assure you,
Mr. Harkin, everything I heard, representing
this is a really big manual. Molecule.
Okay.
You want to get into the nuances of the differences in manufacturing of these biosimilars, too. Or biologicals in general.
Well, I'm assuming Representative Kenner knows all about that.
He will by then.
Mr. Chairman, I'm thinking we'll just talk about how people feel about the different sizes.
I think that's within bounds. Definitely within bounds. All right. I close the work session on Senate Bill 460A. And let's see. Let's go now to continue the public hearing on Senate Bill 572A, which is already open. You want to tell us again what we have, or just call some folks who'll tell us?
Start by calling Linda Enos here. Tell us about the bill.
Okay.
Linda.
Linda.
Hi. This is Mitch Greenlick in the House Committee on Health Care.
Good afternoon. Thank you for letting me do this via phone. I really appreciate it.
Go for it.
Okay. Are you ready for me to start?
Yes, please introduce yourself.
Okay, my name is Linda Enos. I'm an independent consultant in occupational ergonomics, health and safety at HumanFit. I've had that company for 20 years. I'm a certified occupational health nurse and certified professional ergonomist. Can I continue?
Please.
Okay, sorry. Difficult on the phone. I have worked for over 25 years to help companies prevent worker injuries, specifically musculoskeletal disorders such as back strains, in over 150 industries and 25 healthcare facilities in the U.S. I've also assisted for the last 7 years the American Nurses Association with their safe patient handling initiative, including development of the interprofessional national standards for safe patient handling and mobility, which will be released next month. And these standards were developed by 26 volunteer subject matter experts and represent the current evidence base and best practices in safe patient handling in the U.S. at this time across the healthcare continuum and for all healthcare workers. From 2004 to 2011, I also worked as a nursing practice consultant at Oregon Nurses Association and provided free consultation to 20 healthcare facilities in Oregon to assist them to develop and implement safe patient handling programs or projects. In some cases, this support was provided for up to 5 years at a facility. I'm also the co-chair since 2003 for the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Ergonomics, which is a voluntary working partnership between healthcare industry groups and professional associations, workers' comp insurance, and Oregon OSHA. And all of us are dedicated to preventing worker work-related injuries to healthcare workers and enhancing patient safety in Oregon. The proposed amendments to Senate Bill 572 that you have before you today reflect the current evidence base in safe patient handling practices and programs, and also the soon-to-be-released national ANA standard. With your permission, I'd like to briefly summarize those amendments. Is that okay with you?
Yes, please. Briefly was the key word.
As briefly as I can, as a fair few. So in short, hospitals across Oregon have to have a safe patient handling committee that will implement and monitor a program and policy. The Department of Consumer and Business Services, per rule, would determine the makeup of that committee, but it should include nurses, aides, patient transporters, and other care providers that move and lift and provide direct care for patients. And this program would be developed based on hazard assessment of the areas where patient handling, moving, repositioning occurs, the type of patient needs clinically, and the task being performed. And it's expected that lift equipment would be used that is appropriate for patient needs, the task being performed at all times, unless there's a medical reason or would be otherwise or otherwise would compromise patient care. Equipment needs to be accessible on all shifts and units where these tasks are performed and maintained per manufacturer's requirements. And there should be an assessment and communication process and plan that identifies each patient's physical, mental, and clinical needs so that the appropriate equipment is used to move or lift them. This assessment is conducted on admission during shift and before moving a patient, and is usually conducted by an RN or delegated as consistent with state laws governing nursing practice. A process to address staff safety if a patient refuses the equipment should be developed. And then committee users and the end users of the equipment should be involved in choosing equipment. The people using equipment would also receive competency-based education initially and ongoing per industry standards. Education is provided to patients and families, and is also posted information about the program. It's posted visibly in patient care areas. Policy would be accessed by staff, patients, and visitors. And then, of course, in the evaluation process of the there should be an evaluation process of the program periodically by the hospital and feedback to the committee to determine if the program reduces the number of musculoskeletal disorders, back injuries, for example, number of days away from work or restricted duty days related to these patient handling tasks. And then from that data, the committee would make recommendations to enhance the program. In addition, the committee should also make recommendations for patient handling, say patient handling to be incorporated in new construction or remodeling. And then lastly, retaliatory action against staff who refuse to move patients manually because there's a lack of equipment or other safety concerns is prohibited, but the staff must notify their supervisor the reason for refusal immediately. The program and policy is due to be in place by February 1, 2017. I hope that made sense. Just to finish up, the programmatic approach outlined in the amendment allows healthcare facilities to implement cost-effective, sustainable, safe patient handling programs that will decrease injuries to nursing aides and other healthcare workers and nurses and enhance patient safety. The proposed amendment should not unduly burden hospitals who have already effective programs. These facilities will be implementing a lot of these elements outlined in the bill. And for the facilities who have not implemented safe patient handling, often because they think they cannot afford to purchase equipment, the legislation provides a framework to implement an effective program that will produce a positive return on investment through decreasing workers' comp costs and staff turnover. And in addition, in the evidence base, we have softer benefits such as improved staff satisfaction, a larger labor pool to draw from. I'm a back injured nurse. I can now return to bedside nursing with the equipment. And, of course, we have safety benefits to patients. I want to highlight that many hospitals, not only in Oregon, but other states, have historically spent money on lift equipment, trained staff, and then they have the lift equipment sit in the storage space and it doesn't get used. So they conclude the programs don't work. Often this is because a systematic approach was not used to match equipment with patient clinical needs or design of the workspace, and there was no way to support change of staff work practice or culture change from manual lifting and moving of patients to using equipment when appropriate. I want to emphasize that as we have done for the past 10 years in Oregon, the Oregon Coalition for Healthcare Ergonomics will continue to provide evidence-based information, education, resources, and tools related to safe patient handling that will assist healthcare facilities in Oregon to prevent worker injury. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Why don't you, if you have time, why don't you stay on and we'll call the first panel and then we'll see if there are any questions of the whole panel.
Angel Garris, Pinal Patel, and Kelly Pape.
And after that?
After that, Felisa Haggins, Sarah Basler, and Patty O'Sullivan.
Okay. Go for it.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Pape. I was recently a CNA at Albany General Hospital until I was injured 2 years ago. I was injured on the job after two surgeries later, and them telling me I could no longer be a CNA. It would have been greatly appreciated if we would have had the equipment that we needed at the time that I lifted the patient. She was 300-plus pounds, as you can see, I'm not. I did have help from a nurse, and luckily she wasn't not injured, but I kind of got it on both arms. Hopefully, I support the SB 57285, and hopefully it gets passed so that none of my coworkers get injured.
Thank you very much.
Questions?
We'll see. We'll wait to the panel.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angel Garrison. I'm an SEIU member and a member of the Kaiser SAFE team. I have been a CNA for 18 years. I travel throughout the hospital providing lift assistance and training. I am proud of the work that we are doing to protect the safety of our caregivers and our patients. I hope that my experience will help you understand how a good lifting program works. Our safe patient handling program was started 8 years ago with the purchase of lift equipment. We used to have a lift team, but now we have a safety team. Our safe patient handling team that incorporates staff safety into the patient handling program. At Kaiser, we have one SAVE team working per shift. The team works on patient mobility, staff mentoring, and training at the patient bedside, and identifying things that may be at risk to staff safety. It is important to have a team that has critical thinking skills and uses lift equipment often. It is necessary to make the patient the core focus and for the SAVE team members to be engaged in the training of other staff. SAVE team members are always members of the safety committee. We have a room in our hospital that has two overhead lifts for the patients of size. That lift goes up to 1,014 pounds, which unfortunately is necessary in our field. If it wasn't for that room, we would have a lot more injuries. We don't have enough of those rooms. We need more. Right after we started the program, I was working with a brand new nurse. She pulled a muscle in her back lifting a patient. She was injured seriously and had to give up nursing. The SAFE patient handling program has made a huge difference in the intensive care unit at Kaiser Sunnyside Hospital. We have seen a significant reduction in injuries there and at Kaiser in the region. ICU nurses picked the lift equipment we use. The SAFE team went to the equipment manufacturer for training. When I first began working with the ICU staff, many of the nurses were older. They insisted on lifting patients manually, even when mechanical lifts were available. It was an old school culture. They really believed lifting patients manually was the right thing for their patients. I was off work on maternity leave, and when I returned, those nurses were no longer in the ICU. They had quit working at the hospital and taken jobs in clinics where the physical demands were less. I began working with a new crop of nurses. We taught them how to use the mechanical lifts. We taught them that using the lifts properly means the patients are safer. Thanks to good equipment, good training, and a culture of safety, these nurses will be able to work their whole careers in the hospital. And they will retire upright and not in the pain clinics. Lifting puts so many people at risk due to the physicality of our job. We are critical staff to the hospital, our community, and most important, our patients. If we all get broken, we can't show up for work. Please support this bill to ensure safer lifts for staff and for patients. Thank you.
Chair Greenland, members of the committee, my name is Kino Patel. I'm a member of the SEIU Local 49. I've worked as a certified nursing assistant at Legacy Emanuel and Legacy Fitzmanson Hospital for 5 years. I am 29 years old and I've already suffered two major injuries related to lifting patients at work. I live with pain. It is clear to me that I will not be able to continue to do this work up to retirement. It feels like my body is deteriorating day by day. At some point, I will have to do work that puts less strain on my body. Legacy representatives would like to tell you that Legacy has a safe lifting program, but in my experience, it is not good enough to keep staff and patients safe. Some patients' rooms have mechanical lifts, but many rooms do not, and the equipment is faulty. Nursing staff move patients in these rooms without mechanical assistance. Oftentimes, I must lift patients who weigh 200 or 300 pounds by myself. I adjust the patients in bed. I lift them to assist them from the bed to the chair or bed to the commode and back. Hospitals workers do not get enough training on proper use of the equipment. We get only 5 or 10 minutes of training on the lifts every year, and we are not taught proper body mechanics. There is no dedicated safe lifting team to help us learn how to use proper techniques. There isn't the kind of team effort that prevents injuries. In 2009, I hurt my back moving a 300-pound patient. A nurse and I were moving her from the bed to a chair when the patient suddenly became dead weight. We put her down, but I've had sciatica ever since. In 2011, I was kicked in my shoulder while moving a patient. Something tore in my shoulder, but I continued to work. Repetitive lifting worsened my turn, according to the doctor who did a surgical repair on my shoulder 2 months ago. I am not the only one who has been hurt. Two of my coworkers have also had back injuries. If my employer had made an investment in safer lifting handling, I would not have suffered two serious injuries so early in my career. Safer patient handling means fewer injuries to caregivers like me and to our patients as well. We need this bill. Please support it. Thank you.
Are there any questions in this panel?
Just
Ms. Kennemer?
Yeah, Ms. Pepe, were you in a hospital or what was your setting?
Yes, I was at Albany General Hospital.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask you a comment?
Yes, please.
I just want to thank you for your service. Really sounds like incredibly hard work, so thank you. Sorry for your injuries.
Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two questions, probably at least in part directed at Linda, but it sounds like at least in some institutions there's already these programs occurring. For the ones that maybe don't have either don't have an adequate program or don't have some kind of attention on this particular aspect of employee safety at all, presumably the costs of lost hours and accordingly the workers' compensation rate paid by that employer are probably higher. So that was an introduction to question number one, and then I have a second question. Question number one is, do we really need a piece of legislation to mandate this, or you know, are institutions figuring this out for themselves? That's the first question. And the second is, I think
that's a question for our phone.
It is. I'm mainly directing these at Linda.
Okay.
Okay.
You want to take that question, then can I ask a
whichever. Okay. Why don't you ask the second question also?
Okay. So the second question is, so you would never have manual turning of patients, which I find, if I read the bill right, you would always use some kind of mechanical device, which strikes me as maybe overkill. My grandmother was an ER nurse, an ICU, and other things with the VA, and you know, I heard stories about heavy people, big men who she had to get help to turn and stuff. And I think, you know, there's certainly a situation where a mechanical device is needed. I'm not sure. She's a small woman, and I'm not sure that she needed a mechanical device in every situation. So that's, is that true, the way I'm reading the bill, is the second question.
Can I answer both, please?
Please.
The first question about whether we need this, because some hospitals are doing this in Oregon. There's no doubt that, you know, Oregon has done very well due to the efforts of ONA and our coalition and other people. We really pushed this ahead, provided a lot of evidence base, and supported our facilities. And it's not just acute care that needs these programs, but that's another topic. However, if we don't have this as a piece of legislation, it's really not a priority for some hospitals because they're juggling with so much regulation. And to make staff safety that priority, I truly believe we need legislation. And I can say, I work not just in the US, but I have colleagues all over the world. This type of legislation was necessary in Europe 20 years ago and has been very effective. In Canada 15 years ago, Australia and New Zealand. And, you know, we're looking at states like Washington, who've had the legislation for a few years now, and their injury rates and workers' comp costs have decreased as they presented to the legislature. I think overarching, though, if we have legislation, it makes it a priority. It brings it up into view for our healthcare facilities, and we can help make the business case for them, because they will save money in the long run. There's some initial outlay, but they will save a lot of money. And as I said earlier, there's a lot of softer benefits too, and we definitely have the patient safety side. So I hope that answers your question.
The first one.
Yes, the first one. The second one, well, I'm going to try and answer this briefly. No,
Hold on a minute. Is that, are you talking about the issue in, so we can, 3A?
Page 2, line 12 through 16.
And yeah. Section 2, paragraph 3AB.
AB.
I think.
Good. Yes, thank you. You see where we are? We're talking about the amendment now.
Right. So, and it's 3, sorry, can you say that?
Well,
3AB?
We're talking,
right.
If you have the pages, it's line
14.
Line 12 sure. through. Through 16. I guess 15 on page 2.
I think to start off, we should clarify what is a lifting device or something that moves or repositions a patient, because we all think of the floor lifts or maybe a ceiling lift, which is definitely appropriate for patients that cannot move themselves at all. However, we use other devices in safe patient handling, for example, to get people from bed to chairs or to ambulate them. And we do have a problem with assisted falls with patients when we don't use equipment. So the other part of this is using the appropriate equipment that can help functional rehabilitation and improvement in activities of daily living while keeping staff and patients safe. So the key here is the assessment of what the patient can do, what the clinical needs are, and choosing the right equipment. That's why the assessment piece is so important. And of course, in acute care, it changes all the time. Our patients' needs change within a shift. So it's important to know that it's not just about we've got to lift everyone with lifts. That's not appropriate. And there are emergency situations or clinical situations where a device may not be appropriate. And again, that's assessment by the appropriate person, such as a nurse. I do want to just state the evidence base is strong and it's been replicated many times, not just in this country. The cumulative lift load for any healthcare worker, regardless of age, gender, or fitness level, is 35 pounds. So when we look at that, that's less than what we say in industry. Industry workers have a 50-pound load on the job descriptions. But it's 35 pounds, and that's more than most patients' legs weigh. So this isn't about bariatric patients, although that scenario is worse. It's about any patients that can't move themselves, and our workers are cumulatively lifting over time more than 35 pounds. We know what that does to the spine, regardless of age, fitness, or gender.
Thank you. All right, let's call the next panel, if we will. Thank you for being here.
It might be appropriate. Next panel will be fine.
Good. You'll be first in line when they finish.
Felisa Haggins, Sarah Basler, and Patty O'Sullivan.
And as brief as you can.
For the record, my name is Felisa Haggins. I work at SCA Local 49. I'm the political director there. I'm sure you're all familiar with our organization. We're here in support of Senate Bill 572. With the Dash 5 amendments, we believe that this bill, to answer a few of the questions, is necessary to help implement and to help change the culture that a lot of our certified nursing assistants and what we call transporters, they're the folks who move you throughout the hospital, to help with the conditions that they work under. By putting this program in place, we feel like it will increase worker safety and reduce injuries, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, Sarah Basler here for the Oregon Nurses Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 572 with the Dash 5 amendments. As you've heard, safe patient handling is an important workplace safety issue for nurses and other frontline healthcare workers, particularly as patients are increasing in size. Overexertion injuries like those caused by patient lifting are very common in nursing. The U.S. Department of Labor frequently has nurses in the top 10 of the most susceptible occupations to overexertion injuries. Our hope is that with the passage of Senate Bill 572 with the Dash 5 amendments, we'll accelerate the progress that many hospitals around the state have already made in implementing safe patient handling programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And my testimony will be split in sort of two parts. One is process and one is policy. As a way of a little bit of background, a lot of you have known me for a long time, but in my career in state government, I worked for Oregon OSHA for 14 years. I was also the administrator of the Management Labor Workers Comp Advisory Committee for 2 years. So while I don't have the extensive background that your witness on the phone has, I have quite a bit of background and believe very, very strongly in occupational safety and health and implementing safe practices to prevent accidents. They aren't accidents. They are injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. On the policy part of this, I just very quickly want to say I had no idea there were amendments until about 3 minutes before the hearing. What had happened over in the Senate is that my counterpart, Andy Easton, had worked with Felisa on some amendments, and we sent a memo to the group right after that work group saying we still did not agree with the amendments. What happened then was I got called to Senator Mona Sanderson's office, and she did not have the caucus votes to pass the SEIU amendments out. So she asked me, with my background in safety and health, if I would develop some amendments. So I said, sure. So I did. My amendments are what you see in the A engrossed. She then called Felicia and I up there and said, Felicia, they're either these amendments or your bill is dead. And Felicia said, fine, we'll go with your amendments, or we'll go with Patty's amendments. So I did not know that they were coming back here with the original amendments now to put back in the bill. So I'm kind of at a loss to go over that line by line. But now let's get into the policy. I truly believe in injury prevention. So I believe in safe lifting. I believe in safe lifting policies. I believe in programs. I believe in lift equipment when and if it's necessary, and training and education. And I believe that all hospitals also believe that, because as somebody said, I believe Representative Conger, every time a person is off work, we've got to probably pay twice that to get somebody else to take their place. You know, the workers' comp rates go up. There's many reasons. I mean, nursing, in my experience, you know, you're talking sometimes about people falling in a hog and being, you know, pulled out at the other end in a pulp mill. There's a lot of dangerous jobs, and it's very expensive for employers. But more than that, if it's especially a small hospital, they're family. I mean, not really, maybe not blood, but in a small hospital, everybody knows each other. And you don't want your workers and you don't want your families. There's a little saying, and I hate to do this to you guys, but it's, we just come to work here, we don't come to die. And that is how you protect employees, with that thought in mind. So let me get now to the, and you can tell I'm very passionate about it. I spent a lot of my career trying to help protect employees. A lot of our hospitals already have policies, and you know, whether they're effective or not, I believe that the A engrossed that I wrote will help that. But let me first go over a handout. Did we give the handout out? I called the workers' comp department and asked them for incident rates. And the incident rates on any industry can be pulled out of the system by employee type, by you know, what type of injury, etc. What this shows you, and if you look at the top right-hand box, I pulled it out by hospitals and residential care meaning long-term care, which is not included in this bill. And if it's, and just as an aside, it also doesn't include home health workers. And if it's hard to lift a patient in a hospital with equipment and other people available, imagine how hard it is in a home when you're by yourself. In long-term care, if this does not apply to long-term care. In the hospitals, it shows by the employment rate they get from the employment figures that they get from the employment department, approximately 53,000 employees. They had a total, and that's broken down private and public, and remember, the public in hospitals is a state hospital. It's broken down, and there were 85 lifting claims in 2011. That's a rate of 0.1%. I believe that's low. I think there might be some skewed data here. I'm not really sure. That seems low to me, but it's not a lot of people. But to the people that have that injury, it's very, very debilitating for their lives. So I'm not downplaying that. It doesn't matter. Even 85 are preventable and should be prevented. I don't believe that the A5 does it. One thing is, it's too prescriptive. We already have policies. It goes into, you have to give the policy to visitors if they want the policy, and you know that it develops a new committee, when according to the Oregon Safe Employment Act, ORS 654, every workplace has a safety committee already. So if you want to bring attention to this issue, which is, I think, of good value, what I put in the A engrossed and what was passed by the Senate was the A engrossed, is that your safety committee that's already there, would annually have to obtain from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, i.e. workers' comp, the rate of claims for disabling compensable injuries for that hospital and the aggregate rate for all hospitals. So you can see, are you a good player or a bad player? So we can look at the average, but we don't know what's making up that average. Maybe a hospital has real low claims, maybe some have really high claims. So you need to find out what you are, and that safety committee needs to do that. It goes on to say the safety committee needs to review the claims information for disabling compensable injuries caused by lifting, transferring, repositioning, and make recommendations to the governing body of the hospital for ways to prevent disabling compensable injuries similar to the injuries for which claims were filed. And they need to review the rate of claims for the hospital in comparison to the aggregate rate to determine if the safe patient handling policy described in Section 2 of this bill has reduced claims.
Can I ask you to wrap it up?
Yes.
We can read the bill.
And, right. And recommend changes to the policy to reduce those claims. It also mandates that every hospital have a policy on safe lifting. So I guess it's up to this committee what you want to do. What I know is that they tried to get these amendments passed in the Senate and couldn't, and I think that the goal of this bill is to prevent injuries. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Sounds like it was good that I waited, because it sounds like Patty might be better served to answer this question, but I come from the industrial environment that you had mentioned. And what I was seeing with this, OSHA is who regulated us. And does not OSHA regulate hospitals or look at hospitals as well, or are they on a separate?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Widener, you're exactly right. The original bill put this mandate for a policy and everything around it into the healthcare statutes, and it's now in the ANGROS, moved into 654, which is the Oregon Safe Employment Act, and that's correct. They do regulate all that. They don't have anything specific to lifting. This would make something specific, but there, as you know, there's lifting in every kind of industry and ergonomic methods and all that, so they do have some things that respond to that, but nothing specific to a hospital lifting sort of dead weight, no. So this would be a first on that.
May I follow up? The other question I kind of have, coming from the industrial environment, we had certain things, like if a guy didn't have fall protection and climbed out over a ledge or something like that, it was lots of times immediate dismissal. I mean, we would fire him on the spot if they did that. And the thing I'm seeing with this, it's kind of one-sided. Would a hospital be able to implement that policy if somebody did not adhere to the policy of lifting and they're supposed to have three people or use this lift, yet they try to do it by themselves? Would they be able to terminate that employee?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Widener, the Oregon Safe Employment Act does not really specify individual punishments for not following rules or regulations, but what it does say is that an employer is the employer is the one responsible for the workplace and for safety and health. How that's then translated into, well, what do you do when people don't follow the rules, is that you have to show as an employer what you have done, progressive discipline, and of course, if it's union, that contract would talk about the progressive discipline, and up to including firing, depending on what the violation and what they didn't. I mean, if you didn't shore a trench, that's not good. If you don't wear safety protection on a roof, if you don't have time or something to call somebody else to lift and you get hurt, probably not a fireable offense. So it sort of grades up and down as depending on what you violate. But it doesn't specify that. It makes the employer responsible. And then within that, they have to set up some sort of a system, either with a union or, if it's not a union shop, a policy to tell you, if you violate this, this will happen to you.
Representative Kinnaman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a couple of comments. One is, in a couple of discussions that I've had with people, I'm a little disappointed that I didn't understand there had been an agreement reached previously. That makes a difference in my thinking. But I guess more to the point, a couple of things. One, back in the final days of my first wife's illness. She was about 120 pounds, and I'm almost double that. It was amazing how difficult and how heavy she was, and I have great empathy for that. On the other hand, I think most every hospital has this, and I'm very familiar with workers' comp rates. And I find it very difficult to understand that there's a problem in hospitals, because back injuries tend not to be easily rectified. In fact, they tend often to, back surgeries are notoriously unsuccessful, so they create long-term disability, which is a very serious concern for the worker, but also a concern for the person who pays those workers' comp rates. And I'm just having a hard time understanding why this is necessary. I mean, are we that far away from good sense in the hospitals? Maybe that's a comment rather than
I experience the answers, yes. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 572 and take under advisement where we are at the moment, and we'll carry over the work session.
Excellent.
To Monday. Okay, I'm carrying over. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 724. We have in the discussion of the public hearing both the bill itself and an amendment proposal. So, will you tell us what we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 724A requires the Oregon Health Authority to develop account method for innovative non-traditional services by August 1st, 2013. It requires the Health Authority Department of Human Services to provide coordinated care organization statements of their costs and transferring the service responsibilities to coordinated care organizations. Coordinated care organizations assume cost of service. The Health Authority and Department of Human Services shall report to the Legislative Assembly no later than February 1st of the following year. It declares an emergency effective on its passage.
We have two witnesses on the original bill and two witnesses on the, or three, I guess, on the...
Two
on the amendment.
Veronica Sheffield and Josh Ballack on the original bill, and after that, Greg Miller, and we'll call Evelyn Cole.
Good afternoon. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name for the record is Veronica Sheffield, and I'm the Director of Special Programs at WBP Health Authority, and I support Senate Bill 724, which creates a billing system for CCOs to pay for non-medical health services. I've been a nurse case manager serving this population, Oregon Health Plan, for over 12 years, and there are thousands of non-medical health services that do not exist under the current accounting system. We've all heard about Governor Kitzhaber's air conditioners, but there are numerous things that we as nurse case managers would love to be able to integrate into someone's care plan and provide for them to provide holistic care. And I just wanted to provide a couple of examples. Recently, Willamette Valley Community Health received a request from a young member who was unable to speak. And in the process of case managing this young man, we found that at school he had an iPad with appropriate software that he was using in his classroom, and that's what he needed at home to be able to communicate with his family and with his healthcare providers, because when he was at home outside the school systems, he was using picture cards to communicate. So it made sense to buy him an iPad, but there's no billing code for that. It's something that we did as the CCO, but it was done under the administrative budget. And I know the state, so that's one example. Another example is I know the state is working hard on billing codes for non-traditional health workers, and I'm really grateful for that. We have a program that's used non-traditionals for the last 7 years for women who are struggling with drugs and alcohol during pregnancy. It's nationally recognized. It's called the MOMS program. But that holistic approach in that program often involves paying for things that don't have traditional billing codes, things like transportation for non-medical appointments such as housing appointments and job interviews and providing DHS-approved safe child care while women aren't in prenatal depression classes and living healthy and nutrition classes to be able to feed their families healthy meals. So we're paying for a lot of things outside what we would consider traditional, in that traditional healthcare box, but they're things that really improve women's health and the lives of our members. So I thank you for your time.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Josh Ballack, representing the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon. We very much support Senate Bill 724, excuse me. I just wanted to come up and say we really appreciate the help of the Oregon Health Authority and the Governor's Office in helping get this bill crafted the right way. We'd work with them very closely and hopefully have a very good bill that will actually result in the better holistic care for our clients and give the tools to the CCOs they need to be able to do the things that Veronica needs to get done to get this working.
I'd like to ask a question. I checked in with OHA in advance to find out why the money went in a blended bucket, a global budget, and why was it necessary to try and figure out how to get codes to actually bill. The understanding I got, and I'd like to check it out with you, is it isn't really billing because the money's there. It's really an accounting issue.
It is an accounting issue.
Just to figure out where to put.
Yeah, because otherwise it looks like you're using this percentage for administrative services when a lot of that is actually going for direct care to the members that we're serving. So being able to really say, you know, we bought this iPad for this young man. I know it doesn't have a billing code, but it makes sense for him to be able to communicate.
And you already have your money, whether or not
yes,
you did
so this. This is not additional money. It's just being able to say we are using this money, this pot of money, for services that directly impact members.
I also proposed to them an amendment that if you bought an air conditioner, it'd be charged directly to the governor.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, that would have been nice. We got some calls about whether or not we were paying for air conditioners.
Okay. Are there other questions?
Actually,
my
Mr.
nurses
Chair,
all laugh about that.
I just had to buy my wife an IPAC, so this would have been nice to take care of that.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for
thank
your
you.
Time.
Hi, hold on just a moment. This is Mitch Greenlick in the House Healthcare Committee.
Yes.
You want to start?
Yeah, please. respectfully, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Miller. I represent the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. We've had an amendment drafted to Senate Bill 724 that seeks to address an issue between ASCs and how they're compensated from insurers for the services they provide. The current situation is such that a patient who uses their out-of-network benefit under their insurance plan is permitted to use an ASC who is out-of-network, obviously with that insurance plan. The insurers, however, are permitted to send payment for that service to the patient. Therefore, the ASC has to spend quite a bit amount of time and money trying to track down that payment from the patient if they can obtain that payment from the patient at all. So Senate Bill 724, the -A3 amendment you may have in front of you, but that does need to have a small technical fix that I'll address. But what the amendment does is requires the insurance company to send payments. It can still go to the patient, but it would be a dual endorsed check. So it would have the patient's name as well as the center that performed the surgery on that check so that the patient couldn't unilaterally cash it and steal away with the money. The second thing that the bill does is it allows allows the ASC to balance bill a patient under two circumstances specifically, the first being for implants necessary for orthopedic surgeries, back surgeries, spine surgeries, et cetera, et cetera. Typically, those implants are not reimbursed. Therefore, the ASC either has to bill the patient for them or which the patients are, many times are willing to pay for or eat that cost as a matter of the health care they provide. The other thing that it allows is for the ASC to balance bill a patient up to 70% of the difference between the insured's allowed amount and the billed amount that the ASC submitted for payment.
That's without any limit to the billed amount. That's without any limit to the billed amount. The billed amount can be anything.
That's correct. There are what are called usual and customary charges that the ASCs do kind of in their billing practices. There are ASCs in the state, a small handful, that do have what may be characterized as exorbitant billing practices. OASCA does not condone those billing practices, but the 70% that we're suggesting here at least allows them to recuperate some of the loss that they would have if they only had to accept the defined benefit in the member's plan.
Okay, thank you. Don't go away. Ms. Cole?
Yes.
Would you introduce yourself and testify, please?
My name is P. Evelyn Cole, and I'm the CEO with Kuiper Spine and Spine Surgery Center of Eugene.
Yes, go ahead, please. Ms. Cole, are you still there?
Yes.
Would you do you have any testimony to offer?
I'm in support of this bill. One of the situations that happens with us is that none of our surgeries are on the Medicare approved list. And so we are pretty much at the mercy of whatever insurance companies choose to allow for these surgeries. And most of the time, on a contract basis, they do not put implants into the contract as reimbursable. And because spine implants are so expensive, we really need some mechanism to make sure that we get paid for our implants.
Okay, thank you. I understand there's been discussions between the insurance companies and you all, and there are going to be competing amendments. The double bill, everybody now agrees to, but there's some question about the balance billing. And I've instructed the insurance representatives to produce an amendment that is their version. It would be very useful if you guys could get together and figure out how to get something that's workable for both of you. And we'll carry this over to allow time to do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've attempted to do that since 2011. We've actually been trying to get into conversations with some of the insurers to talk about this specific issue. It's been held over time and again. We did meet with them a few weeks back with Senator Mortis Anderson and Representative Thompson. We did talk about the dual check. Their suggestion back to us was eliminating or prohibiting balance billing, which is a significant problem for my client.
So you don't want any further talk. It'll just be your amendment versus their amendment, and we'll pick one of them and go with it, or do you want to try and move this along further?
If they're open to more discussion on that, I'm happy to work with them on it.
Well, I'll tell you the options. There'll be that amendment, and I'll have an amendment available that only does the double check without anything about balance billing. And if you can't work out some compromise in the next week or so, then we'll pick one of the three. But I'd rather you come up with some compromise on some limits on that balance billing to deal with the question of the seemingly exorbitant rates. And we'll reschedule this bill. For what? Yeah, we'll reschedule it for the 29th for a work session. Are there questions of the witnesses?
A couple. We don't have to do it here today. We can do it offline. But come to me, this issue of implants. I don't understand why we're using surgical implants that insurance companies don't pay for. Some more information around that would be appreciated. And also the issue on the balance billing. I have a question, probably because I don't understand it, but 70% of an unknown number is an increasingly larger number. I may as well make it 100% of a known number as opposed to 70% of something that can just be escalated and it could be bigger, you know. So I don't see there's any sideboards on this for bad actors, and that would, it's a bit of a concern to me.
I propose the insurance company, if they want to suggest something, it'd be something like 2 times the Medicare reimbursement rate is the upper limit on...
Yeah, something, that addresses bad actors. Otherwise, you just raise the price through the ceiling and you get more at 70% than you would have originally got at 100%.
That's so right. Okay, well, thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing. We'll schedule a work session for this on the 29th of April.
May.
Of May, of course. The 29th of May or June or some date. The 29th of May, so give it that day and the next day, so we'll work on it. And thank you very much. We need a little change in the carriers. If, Mr. Administrator, do you need that publicly or can you just do it?
Well, if you want to do it now, it's fine.
Okay, we're going to move Representative Conger over to
384.
And we'll ask Representative Williamson to assist you in that as a dual carrier. And we'll move Representative Kenny Geyer to 172.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, do we need a dual carrier? I mean, I'm fine with Representative Williamson just carrying it.
Whatever is your
pleasure. We didn't ask her, and she didn't introduce him. So
did she ask us?
We'll put you on it.
Did she ask to
carry
it?
She asked us to carry it.
Yeah, let's let her carry it. I don't think this is a bill that needs... two carriers. Okay. I mean, I'm happy to speak on it if we need to. But
all right. Well, we'll let Representative Williamson carry.
I didn't realize she asked.
384. Okay. Thank you all for coming. Remember, the reward for this is
next
Friday off.
So we're going to hold you to
I'm not
that.
Sure that's believable
I'm
either.
So upset I'm not going to come Monday either.
We've already announced that agenda is gone, so you are off next Friday afternoon.
Most excellent.
Do we have anything else?
Yes, sir.
Look at the time.
I know.
Yeah, good job.
Nice work.
Good work. Happy weekend.
Yeah.